Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama said today he's got a plan to stop the manipulation of oil prices, upon which the price of crude promptly rose a buck and a half. Oil, energy, and the election on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday. It's the 17th of April. Good as always to have you with us. For those who wince at paying $70 every time you swing by the gas station, rest assured the White House knows you're unhappy. Today, President Obama said he's going to crack down on speculation in the oil markets. He wants Congress to spend $52 million to beef up federal oversight of crude and how it's traded. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, we asked Sarah Gardner to find out whether that's all it would take.
President Obama says an irresponsible few are rigging the energy markets for their own gain. He didn't name the few, but implied that traders were manipulating the markets by colluding with each other. The president said they were buying up oil, creating the perception of a shortage, and driving prices higher. Then they sell for a quick buck.
We can't afford a situation where some speculators can reap millions while millions of American families get the short end of the stick.
Analyst Fadel Gate at Oppenheimer & Company says speculative betting is part of the DNA of oil prices. He figures at least 20%. But Gate says Obama's fixes, higher fines, more cops on the beat, and making it more costly for Wall Street to trade oil futures won't work.
There are tens of billions of dollars to be made in oil price speculation. So those people are willing to spend 10 times more to fool government regulators and to hide their tracks.
But Blake Clayton at the Council on Foreign Relations says speculation is a scapegoat. Clayton says there may be some market abuses, but they're not responsible for $4 gas.
The truth is, supply and demand right now augur in favor of high prices.
And nobody, he notes, seems to be complaining about all the speculative betting in the natural gas markets right now. Natural gas prices are currently at 10-year lows. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Never fear, Apple's back. After a big sell-off the past couple of days, shares were up hard today, back over $600 a share. Here's another recent number from Techland. For you, $1 billion. That, of course, is what Facebook is paying for Instagram, the crazy popular photo app with, it must be said, no profits. Millions upon millions of other dollars are flooding into all sorts of other tech startups and apps of the moment. So, can you spell tech bubble? Marketplace's Queen of Kim can.
We won't know that we're in a tech bubble until it bursts. And since Silicon Valley has yet to invent the time machine app, it's still an open question. Alex Field, an economics professor at Santa Clara University, says history has shown us that there are signs.
The kind of thinking that, well, I don't think that this valuation is particularly justified, but everybody else seems to be thinking that way, and therefore, you know, if I buy this and then sell it subsequently, I'm going to be able to make money.
In other words, leaving behind your critical mind and going with the crowd. Field doesn't think we're in a tech bubble yet.
You know, the NASDAQ peaked, I think it was in March of 2001, at over 5,000. And here we are more than 10 years later, and, you know, we're not even close to that.
And unlike the last time around, he says the environment in Silicon Valley is very different now. Companies like Apple, Google, Facebook are making tons of money, unlike, say, the flameouts of the last boom. Remember Pets.com? Henry Blodgett is a former tech analyst and CEO of Business Insider.
I think if you're asking whether any particular investment is a bubble or was stupid, you have to look at it in the context of the strategy of the individual investor or the company that is paying the price.
Unlike the rest of us, venture capitalists are laying down chips on companies knowing that most of them will fail. But given the climate and media frenzy surrounding stories like Instagram, Alex Field, the economics professor, says that's really hard to remember. I'm Queenie Kim. For Marketplace.
The Pulitzer Prizes came out yesterday, among the top honors for journalism, letters, drama, and music in this country. The one that's got people gossiping today is the one that wasn't given, the prize for fiction. Three finalists, none of which were judged good enough, which can't be good for the book business. Marketplace's Sally Herships has the story from New York.
We're so used to focusing on winners. What does it mean to be just a finalist?
Well, it certainly can't hurt.
Jeff Seroy works for Farrar, Straus & Giroux, which publishes Dennis Johnson's book, Train Dreams, one of the three Pulitzer finalists.
They'll all get more attention and readers will be curious about them. Maybe readers will want to read all three and decide for themselves which should have won, since the board hasn't seen fit to.
Seroy says any publisher will tell you when it comes to driving book sales, the Pulitzer is the most influential award in the country. Paul Bogarts works with Knopf Doubleday. He says this year's result is a huge disappointment. Last year, Knopf's A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan won the prize.
In 2010, we probably sold about 30,000 copies. In 2011, when the Pulitzer was awarded, we went on to sell over 260,000.
Bogart says the Pulitzer effect on book sales comes from the press. After all, they are mainly journalism awards, so the prizes are covered by almost every outlet in America. Jason Bogue is editor of Gallicat, a publishing industry blog. He says publishers count on winners to get consumers into bookstores.
The name recognition of people listening to the evening news and hearing Pulitzer Prize winner, that's the actual moment that catalyzes in your head when you say, I'm going to go to the bookstore and buy that book.
Maybe next year we'll read a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel about tragic injustice. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, my goodness, but traders were enthusiastic. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The confusing housing news of the day, as if there were any other kind, comes courtesy of what seems to be a pair of mutually exclusive statistics that came out this morning. The number of housing permits issued last month, they were up versus housing construction actually begun. That was down. We've called Susan Wachter. She teaches real estate, among other things, at Wharton to help us explain. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
So as part of our never-ending quest to understand the American housing market, help me make sense of the disparity here between actual construction and the number of permits being issued for construction.
Permits is forward-looking, and the forward-looking view right now, consistent with other data out there, is the market is improving slowly, but it's improving. Now, the starts is very much a up and down, especially in the multifamily side, and it turns out that the unexpected decline is entirely in the multifamily side.
So that is apartment buildings.
That's correct. Five units and more.
Does this then make you hopeful? I mean, as a woman who studies this as part of her job, help the rest of us understand it.
Yeah, it's consistent with continuing hope. It certainly reflects the optimism that permits up. There are people who are expecting to build. You know, construction is a funny number here because we've got an inventory that's too high,
right,
and we have potential more supply coming out there if there's additional foreclosure.
Right.
So do we actually want more construction? Not for the housing market.
Well,
we do want more construction for jobs.
Right. But that's what I was going to ask you. Why is anybody out there building homes when we've got all this inventory out there?
Well, first of all, they're building multifamily, and rentership is increasing. People are choosing to be renters.
Do we have inventory where people want to live, right? In you know, the coasts and the major cities?
Not necessarily.
Right.
That's where we're seeing not only house prices firming, but rents increasing. So we already have increases in rents where the jobs are and where people are moving to get those jobs.
You know, you talk about health in multifamily, right? Five units or more. But isn't sort of the indicator of the real estate market the single-family home?
Well, of course, single-family housing is what's the most important indicator. So the fact that multifamily is on its feet and, in fact, rents are going up isn't where we should seek reassurance for the overall economy.
Right.
We need to have not only signs of green shoots and people out there saying, yeah, it looks like a bottom is forming. we actually have to see that bottom before we'll have a return of confidence.
With the caveat that you are an academic and not an analyst, the never-ending search for the bottom in this housing market, are we close? I mean, you know, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, said on Friday, yeah, we're at the bottom.
Well, far from me for contradicting Jamie Dimon.
That's right.
I think we're at the bottom.
Really?
Yeah, I think we are. Obviously, we don't know where interest rates are going to go. We don't know whether unemployment is continuing to drop. Those are, of course, key factors going forward.
Susan Wachter, she's a professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks a lot for your time.
Pleasure.
On the theory that since you're listening to this program, you probably like public radio, let me ask you a question. Do you happen to be a member of your local public radio station? I ask because one of the on-again, off-again debates in Washington, D.C. is over who ought to pay for public broadcasting. The government, which helps support hundreds of public radio stations across the country, or us, listeners who give hundreds of millions of dollars every year to help get shows like this one on the air. Commentator Tucker Carlson says listeners could and should pay more.
I love public radio. I listen to it every day. But sometimes, as I drive to my white-collar job in my expensive foreign car, surrounded by fellow public radio listeners driving to their white-collar jobs in their expensive foreign cars, I feel a little guilty. All of us are pretty affluent, I think to myself. Do we really need a federal subsidy? I live in Washington, D.C., but the scene would be familiar to anyone who lives in Winnetka, Illinois, the North Shore of Boston, or the West Side of L.A. In general, the richer the zip code, the more people tune in to public radio. Public radio listeners tend to have household incomes more than $30,000 above the national average. They're also whiter, better educated, and more than twice as likely as ordinary Americans to work in top management, not the profile of your average welfare recipient. Yet, in effect, that's what we are. Public radio receives more than $100 million a year in tax dollars. Teenage shift workers at McDonald's, harried single moms emptying waste baskets at law firms, farm workers picking lettuce in California, all are laboring so that you and I, you and your Prius, me and my Saab, can listen to a certain sort of educated news and opinion as we cruise in air-conditioned comfort to the office every day. Has there ever been a more unfair tax? Every few years, somebody in Congress tries to kill it. Public radio executives never quite defend their subsidy. That would be impossible to do with a straight face. But instead, they respond by pointing out that lots of people really, really like public radio. That's true. Of course, you could also say the same thing about the Rush Limbaugh show. And that's the point. When people like something, they will pay for it. Public radio listeners certainly could pay the whole tab for public radio. They just don't want to. Maybe, just to be decent, we should start.
Tucker Carlson is the editor-in-chief of The Daily Caller and a member of Maine Public Broadcasting. His father, for the record, used to be the president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Share your thoughts about this or anything else you hear on the program. Marketplace.org is the website. Coming up, kids, consumers, and corporate responsibility.
This millennium generation, these young people, are going to demand that from you. Everybody's making the same stuff, and the consumer has the final say.
A conversation from the corner office with Yvon Chouinard. He's the founder of Patagonia. But first, let's do the numbers. On Wall Street today, the pain of Spain went mainly down the drain. Man, I love that one. Renewed confidence in the Spanish economy and strong U.S. earnings sent the Dow Industrial surging 194 points, 1.5%, closed at 13,115. The S&P 500 ticked up 21 points, also 1.5%, ended things at 1390. The NASDAQ added 54 points, 1.8%, finished at 3042. When the NASDAQ jumps like that, you can pretty much bet Apple had a good day, and indeed it did. As I said, back over $600 a share, that was a 5% gain. On the big board, stocks shrugged off slack manufacturing and housing data and responded to corporate profits. Coca-Cola shares bubbled up 2% after the beverage giant reported strong earnings. Walmart added 2% as well. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to an even 2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the House Committee on Foreign Affairs discusses North Korea after Kim Jong-il. President Obama is in the Cleveland, Ohio area to speak at an event on the economy. And get out and enjoy some music. April is Jazz Appreciation Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Given the weather this past winter, that'd be unexpectedly warm, this has not been a great year for ski resorts, not a whole lot of snow. But it's been a really good year for the ski business. Colorado companies bought two big resorts here in California, which has locals complaining about a veil invasion. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler takes us up to Lake Tahoe for a little après-ski economics.
Welcome to North Star California Resort's information radio system.
The North Star Ski Resort has its own dedicated radio broadcast.
Shopping and dining is located just across from the village on North Star.
The resort provides the little extras, like complimentary carts, so skiers don't have to carry all that cumbersome gear.
It's a really great idea. I wish more places did that.
Should more resorts copy North Star? Many skiers are nervous that consolidation will lead to cookie-cutter ski resorts. Vail Resorts, based in Colorado, now owns three ski operations in the Tahoe area. North Star, Heavenly, and last month, it bought Kirkwood for $18 million. I asked Vail co-president Blaze Carrig if Kirkwood will get a glitzy makeover.
Kirkwood is much different than North Star, and you know we're going to work hard to preserve and protect that. Even though we're a large company with multiple resorts, it's not like a fast food chain where each one of them should be the same.
There are signs of creeping uniformity. Popular retail chains seem to proliferate at the big resorts. Consider where I met Jamie Scheckman.
We're at the world's first ski in, ski out Starbucks, mid-slope here at 8,200 feet.
Scheckman is co-founder of the Mountain Rider Alliance, a skiers group dedicated to making the sport affordable and sustainable. We met at the Squaw Valley Ski Resort, which is owned by another Colorado company, KSL Capital Partners. This season, Squaw bought the neighboring resort, Alpine Meadows. Scheckman says the lack of competition has made lift tickets more expensive.
Prior to the merger, Alpine Meadows was $73. Now you're forced to pay $92. Child's tickets went from $10 to $29.
But Squaw Valley has also cut some prices. For example, Squaw season passes have gotten less expensive in recent years. That's good for consumers, but challenging for the smaller ski resorts trying to compete. John Munson handles marketing for Sugar Bowl, another small resort in the Tahoe region. It charges the same price as Squaw for a season pass.
Some people point blank have said, you know, how can you charge more than, you know, say the neighboring resort when you're not as big? Well, we're not going high volume. You know, smaller lift lines and more elbow room out on the mountain.
In fact, Munson is taking advantage of the local backlash against Colorado corporations. Sugar Bowl has taken out ads in local magazines that read,
California owned and operated since 1939.
The Colorado companies could argue that's the problem with Tahoe. It's stuck in the past. Andy Wirth is president and CEO of Squaw Valley Ski Holdings.
Lake Tahoe really has never been considered seriously by most North American skiers as a serious destination. The resort infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure has been 20 years behind Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming.
John Munson at Sugar Bowl admits consolidation can benefit all Tahoe ski resorts.
These acquisitions have brought with them an unprecedented level of capital improvement dollars. I mean, we're talking tens of millions of dollars.
Squaw Valley is investing $50 million in improvements. Squaw CEO Andy Wirth says that money provides local construction jobs.
Many of the contractors and subcontractors that were either unemployed or underemployed, we're now providing them opportunity.
Wirth wants to bring the 2022 Olympics to Tahoe. His counterpart at Vail is of two minds. He'd be delighted to see the Games come to California, but just as happy if the Olympics end up in Colorado. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
could call Yvonne Chouinard an accidental environmentalist. It sounds unkind, but I'm not saying anything that the founder of Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company, doesn't say about himself. As a younger man, Chouinard was a pioneering mountaineer. He started making climbing equipment in his parents' backyard back in the 1950s. He has since built a brand that anybody who's ever gone on a hike knows about. And he's driven that company to profitability and to activism. From the importance of paying a living wage to a defense of the environment, Patagonia reflects Chouinard's vision of how companies ought to be run. It's a vision he details in his new book, The Responsible Company. So in today's Conversations from the Corner Office, Yvonne Chouinard and the lessons he learned when his climbing gear, pitons specifically, that you hammer into the rock when you're up on the mountain, wound up doing more harm than good.
Yeah, well, that was an unintended consequence of thinking that we were doing the right thing. You know, we made our pitons out of harder steel so that they could be taken out and put in and taken out and put in and last a long time. But it turned out when there got to be so many climbers around putting them in and taking them out that it started destroying the rock. And that was kind of our first lesson in the fact that we were causing the damage, so therefore we should do something about it.
Of course, there is that responsibility tax, right? Because I can come to Patagonia and spend $200 on a really useful coat, but I can go to the Gap and get one for $49.99.
Well, somebody said, you know, poor people can't afford to buy cheap goods. I mean, you know,
that's a great line.
You can go to a Costco and buy a blender. First time you put ice in it, it'll blow out. Save up, wait until you can afford a really good one that'll last the rest of your life.
This book is an evangelical book in the very secular sense. You want people to read this and change the way they do business. Do you care, though, why they change? Is it okay if they're doing it for the good PR and for the benefits that they might get for good publicity? Or is it important that they do it for the right reasons?
No, it doesn't matter why they do it, as long as they do it. I think if you start out on that process of trying to be more responsible, after a while, you realize how good it feels. It becomes a habit. And you know, this millennium generation, these young people are going to demand that from you. Everybody's making the same stuff. And the consumer has a final say.
Do you ever sit back and think how interesting it is that you, a 73, 74-year-old guy, is trying to give the millennials what they want?
Yeah, I never thought I'd come to this at all. But I do this because I'm very pessimistic about the fate of the planet. And I think there's another way of doing business that is less harmful.
I found it interesting that, and you make a point of this actually, that you don't talk about sustainability a lot. You say that's kind of overused and it's become a little bit
It's like gourmet, you know. And, you know, you get gourmet hamburgers now. I mean, it's a watered-down word. And there is no sustainability as far as any human economic endeavor. I mean, we're polluters here, and we recognize that. All you can do is work towards minimizing the damage that you do. You'll never be sustainable.
You're in Patagonia is in a number of associations and organizations with Walmart, which I just find fascinating. You'd think you guys would be uneasy bedfellows at best.
Yeah, no, we've been advising them and working with them on creating a sustainability index for clothing. You know, within a few years, a customer will be able to go into a department store and they can zap the barcode with their little electronic gizmo, whatever it is, in a few years. And it'll give a grade on how the labor practices were in making that pair of jeans and all the environmental impacts. And there'll be a grade. And so the customer will be able to say, oh, this is a 2, this is a 10. I'm going to buy the 10.
When you started, however many years ago it was, did you ever think you'd be sitting here running a company that's trying to change the world?
No, absolutely not. I'm not very good at thinking into the future. I've kind of lived for the day.
Oh, come on. I don't actually believe that.
No, I'm not that good at it.
What's next then? I mean, there's more, right?
Well, as soon as you leave, I'm going surfing.
Oh, man. Yvonne Chouinard, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, we saw an item in the Atlantic magazine the other day about a guy named Lenny Giglio saying he's the barber at the Federal Reserve. And we wondered two things. A, the Fed has its own barbershop, and B, come on, really? That's where Ben Bernanke gets a shave and a haircut? But then...
Federal Reserve Board, Dennis speaking. How may I direct your call?
I'm looking for Lenny the barber, please.
One second.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, is this Lenny?
Yes, it is.
Lenny, it's Kai Rizdahl at Marketplace in Los Angeles. How are you?
What is Marketplace?
So we're a show on business and the economy. Mostly what we want to know is what it's like to cut Ben Bernanke's hair.
Just like cutting yours, I'm pretty sure.
Well, except I have more hair than the chairman does.
Well, yeah, but do you have a beard, too?
No, I don't. And that's the thing.
Okay.
Do you do his beard, too?
Yeah, I do trim his beard.
Now, how often does he come in for a haircut?
I don't know, about every 3 weeks or so.
Is your shop actually in the Fed building?
Yeah.
And can anybody come in and get a haircut?
If they know me. Yeah, I won't take anybody new. No, you have to have a reference.
No, come on.
No, I'm serious.
So you're a sole proprietorship, I guess.
I am a sole proprietorship, and I do pay rent on this space. The Fed doesn't give me anything.
No, come on, really?
Yeah, I don't want a congressional hearing because we got the damn space that they're giving away.
So let me ask you this. Is Ben Bernanke a good guy? I mean, what do you guys talk about?
Ben Bernanke is a great guy.
What do you guys talk about when he's getting a haircut?
We talk about baseball a lot.
Is that right?
He's a great baseball fan. He should be the commissioner of baseball. That's what he should be.
Well, Lenny Giglio, thanks very much for your time.
Okay. Now, you know, see, I didn't even get to plug my son's book.
Well, go ahead. What's the book?
It's called Love Thy Neighbor, and it's by Mark Giglio, and it's been out 3 weeks. You look it up.
Lenny the Barber at the Fed. Go figure that out. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Thanks today to Justin Ho and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here, tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.